Perry Weitz, I believe is the correct pronunciation, and Arthur Luxembourg versus Russell Marsh, Vice Chair, Southern Nevada Disciplinary Board and the State Bar of Nevada, case number 81730. Justice Kadish is not on the bench. Excuse me, Justice Stiglitz is not on the bench, but will be participating in the deliberations of this case. All right, are you ready to proceed? We will start anew, and good to see both counsel and Mr. Campbell. It's especially nice to see you up and Adam, and we're looking forward to starting the arguments anew.
Likewise, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Hardesty. May it please the court. Colby Williams appearing on behalf of the petitioners. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Very good. I feel like I should start my presentation by saying something along the lines of take two, but I'll just start at the beginning and wait for the court's questions. To reset the stage, we're here to discuss the reach of Supreme Court Rule 99. That's the rule that governs the disciplinary jurisdiction of the State Bar of Nevada. And more specifically, we're here to discuss whether that rule can be stretched to impose disciplinary jurisdiction over two New York attorneys, Perry Weitz and Arthur Luxembourg, whose law firm engaged in the following activity. One, it advertised nationally. Two, it entered into a retainer agreement with a Nevada resident who responded to that national advertising. And three, the firm performed some preliminary legal work on behalf of that client in New York. Specifically, it evaluated Mr. Carew's medical records before ultimately determining it would not move forward with the representation. Based on those facts, we submit that Supreme Court Rule 99 cannot reach Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxembourg. Now, the vice chair of the Southern Nevada disciplinary panel saw it differently. Vice Chair Marsh found that the bar could exercise jurisdiction when he denied our motion to dismiss, and he did so on two bases. Number one, he found that by just entering into a retainer agreement with Mr. Carruth, that the law firm was practicing law in Nevada. And number two, he found that because some of the nationwide advertising could be seen in Nevada, that meant that the advertising, quote, regularly appears, end quote, in Nevada, and thus provided an independent basis for jurisdiction. Now, we disagree with both of those propositions. The facts here are relatively undisputed. As we alluded to before, the allegation in the complaint starts by saying that Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxembourg are admitted to practice in Nevada, and everybody agrees that that is not correct. Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxembourg put in declarations explaining that they have no contacts with Nevada, and they had no contacts with Mr. Carruth. Indeed, if you look at the complaint here, there are no allegations individually against Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxembourg other than to say that they are the named partners in the law firm. Now, the law firm likewise has very limited contacts with the state of Nevada. Over its 30-year history, it had three attorneys that were admitted pro hoc vice, and on one occasion, it directed an ad at Nevada. Specifically, it placed an ad in the Las Vegas Review Journal in 2012 regarding defective hip implants. But none of those contacts are at issue in this proceeding. The facts here are pretty straightforward. As I mentioned, the firm engaged in nationwide advertising. Mr. Carruth responded to that advertising. He reached out to the law firm, and the law firm then interviewed Mr. Carruth for purposes of determining whether his case met certain initial criteria. And when I say the firm interviewed Mr. Carruth, it was actually employees of the firm that were conducting this interview. Once that determination was made that Mr. Carruth's case met some initial criteria, then a retainer agreement was sent by mail along with medical authorizations. Mr. Carruth signed those and returned them. The firm then engaged in the normal practice in this type of a case of requesting medical records through the mail. It received those records in the mail, and then it evaluated those records in New York. And after evaluating those records, it determined not to go forward with Mr. Carruth's case. Mr. Carruth was not happy about that. Mr. Carruth believed that the firm was going to pursue a medical malpractice case on his behalf, despite the fact that the first paragraph of the fee agreement says that the firm was not being retained to pursue a medical malpractice case. Be that as it may, Mr. Carruth filed a complaint with the bar. The bar and the firm went back and forth over a number of months where the bar was seeking information, the firm was providing information. Ultimately, the bar decided to impose a public reprimand on the firm for violating Rule 1.4, failing to communicate with a client.
Now, Mr. Williams, when you were providing information back and forth, was there any information about how many times it aired in Nevada?
There was not, Justice Silver. And you're getting to an important point that I was just about to get to, and I'll get there in 1 second to back up and tell you. The important part about the reprimand from our standpoint is that in the reprimand, the bar acknowledged that the firm had not engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. That becomes important in a second. But now getting to your point, Justice Silver, after we objected to the reprimand, the bar filed its complaint. And I would submit that the complaint is more notable for what it doesn't say than what it does, because there are no, other than the erroneous allegations about the lawyers being admitted in Nevada, there are no allegations that Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxenberg practiced law here in any form, whether specially admitted or just were otherwise practicing. The complaint is equally silent when it comes to advertising. In other words, there's no allegation that the firm, that the bar was seeking jurisdiction over the firm because its ads regularly appeared in Nevada. That allegation doesn't exist. My point is that was never the focus in the back and forth between the bar, other than the bar asking the law firm, why didn't you comply with Rule of Professional Conduct 7.2A and get your ad approved in Nevada? And the answer to that question is significant. Rule 7.2A did not apply to this advertising at the time, and this was explained to the bar. In 2017, Rule 7.2 specifically provided that if the advertising was not primarily to be broadcast or disseminated in Nevada, then Nevada's rules governing attorney advertising did not apply to it, and that was the case here. That changed in 2018. And if you want to look at that in the record, that is in the Weitz and Luxenberg response to the bar on December 2nd of 2019. But other than that, advertising was never a focus. There was nothing wrong with the advertising. It wasn't alleged to violate rules of advertising. So that wasn't the focus until the vice chair, when he denied the motion to dismiss, did so on two bases. Number one, after we moved to, I should back up and say, despite the fact that the bar had never taken the position that Mr. Weitz and Luxenberg were actually practicing law in Nevada, that changed when we filed our motion to dismiss. And the bar then said, well, you entered into a retainer agreement, you evaluated his medical records, and you declined the representation. That's practicing law in Nevada. And it relied on the Lerner case for that. And that's Justice Hardesty's, Chief Justice Hardesty's opinion. And this case couldn't be more different than the Lerner case. And very quickly, the non-Nevada attorney in Lerner was practicing out of Mr. Lerner's office in Las Vegas. He was accepting and declining cases. He was sending demand letters. He was settling cases. None of that went on here. But Lerner is important because it gives us two guiding principles. Number one, each case has to be determined on its own facts. And number two, when determining what constitutes the practice of law, you're looking at the exercise of legal judgment to a client problem. And here, yes, did the firm send a fee agreement to Mr. Carruth and sign it? It did. But at that stage, I would submit that was more of a ministerial act. It was not evaluating or applying legal judgment to the client's problem at that stage. The question was, does your case meet an initial set of criteria? If so, we'll send you a retainer agreement so we conduct more investigations or more further investigation, which the firm did by gathering the records and evaluating them in New York, not Nevada. So I would submit that the practicing law prong of Supreme Court Rule 99 does not apply here. Despite the fact that the bar had not relied on this, the vice chair then found, in denying the motion to dismiss, that our advertising appeared regularly in Nevada, although that advertising was nationwide advertising. And the vice chair didn't develop this in much detail, but I would submit that the type of nationwide advertising that is not targeted at Nevada, that appeared, you know, in available cable time slots on national television, is not what Supreme Court Rule 99 is trying to get at when it's talking about advertising that regularly appears in Nevada. So I'm just at about 5 minutes. So unless one of the justices has questions before I stop, I'll turn it over to my colleague. I'll answer anything on rebuttal.
Do the justices have any questions for Mr. Williams? All right, seeing none, counsel, are you ready to proceed for the bar?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Good afternoon, Honorable Justices, and may it please the Court. Kate Flocini, Assistant Bar Counsel, appearing on behalf of the State Bar of Nevada. It seems to me that the overarching question here is, how does the State Bar and this Court protect lawyers' clients, the public, and the integrity of our legal profession if an out-of-state lawyer can engage in misconduct without recourse when an in-state lawyer can't do the same conduct? Mr. Williams has referenced Supreme Court 99 applies here, and it provides that attorneys practicing law in Nevada, whether specially admitted or not, are subject to the court's exclusive disciplinary jurisdiction. And the Lerner case was instructive to us about what constitutes practicing law, in that retaining clients and evaluating claims is the exercise of professional judgment that equates to the practice of law. And the facts are undisputed that that's what happened here. There was a client retained, a Nevada resident retained as a client, and his claims were evaluated by the law firm. Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxenberg argued that under civil litigation standards, there shouldn't be personal jurisdiction over them in this disciplinary case. But disciplinary matters are sui generis. They're neither wholly civil nor wholly criminal matters. And in the matter of Leslie Stovall, which is case number 79949, this court distinguished legal malpractice cases from disciplinary cases. And the court stated that professional discipline is the process through which the public is assured that the legal profession in general operates under meaningful and enforceable standards. This is separate and apart from a legal malpractice action that seeks to compensate a particular client with damages.
Well, Ms. Flocini, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. So let's assume for the moment that, in fact, Mr. Weitz and his partner, Mr. Luxenberg, were in fact practicing law. Rule 99.1 doesn't just require that they be practicing law. It says they must be practicing law here. So what does that mean?
I submit that the practicing law here was satisfied in this particular representation. There's been a lot of conversation about where Mr. White's and Mr. Luxenberg's offices are, their physical offices. But if this last year has taught us anything, it's that the physical location of the practicing attorney is all but irrelevant. In this case, the facts of the representation were all in Nevada. Mr. Carruth, the client, lived in Nevada. He obtained medical services in Nevada, which required the law firm to contact medical providers in Nevada and get those records out of Nevada. Everything was in Nevada. Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxenberg have argued that had they moved forward with the case, there would have been a multi-jurisdiction case filed, perhaps, or the case might have been filed in a different jurisdiction according to where the defendant was located or other jurisdictional considerations. But we didn't get there, so that's speculation. All of the practice of law that happened was in Nevada, was touching Nevada and nowhere else. There's nowhere else that could exercise jurisdiction over this particular matter. There, those hypothetical multi-jurisdictional districts or you know, the district or the other district where a defendant was located couldn't exercise jurisdiction at this point. It'd be completely speculative. So the only state that really was touched by the practice of law in this case was Nevada, the substantive practice of law.
Now, what did Mr. Weitz or Mr. Luxemburg do? That these are two individual attorneys who the bar is seeking to subject to disciplinary proceedings. What did they do that practiced law here?
So the crux of the complaint, the disciplinary complaint in this case, has to do primarily with the way that Mr. Kruth was retained as a client. And Mr. Williams referenced that there were employees who went through a questionnaire, a series of questions with Mr. Kruth when he called in to their hotline. Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg have told us that they created, as part of their firm, created that series of questions. And so while what the employee was doing was ministerial or administrative, it was under the direction, a tight direction, of the lawyers, Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg, the named partners of this law firm. And they were they had established the system by which particular answers resulted in the sending of a retainer agreement to a prospective client so that the client could then retain the law firm. Well, so in Nevada, we have instructed attorneys that there needs to be a lawyer who reviews this. There have been other attorneys, specifically, for example, Layla Hale, who received a letter of reprimand for having a paralegal review the retainer agreement with the client. The attorneys have been instructed through the discipline process that they have to be the ones that are available to review that retainer agreement with the client so that the client understands the scope of the legal representation and what the lawyer is going to do for them and what the lawyer can do for them, and they can make an informed decision about retaining that lawyer for the particular purpose. If a non-lawyer is speaking with the client about those particular facts, then we've got the learner situation where we've got someone applying the professional judgment, law to fact, on behalf of another when they're not qualified to do that. So all of the system, all of the instructions were created by the lawyers that then the administrative staff engaged in. And no, there was never a lawyer that spoke with this particular client, our grievant, until they declined the representation. He did not understand the scope of the representation as would be required by Rule of Professional Conduct 1.4. And that's what the state bar, and I want to just be clear for the record, what initially happened was that the screening panel issued a letter of reprimand, which is the purview of a screening panel under Supreme Court Rule 102, because it's the lowest form of discipline. And it is, although public, pursuant to Supreme Court Rule 121, it is the lowest form of discipline. And we've gotten to this point in the process because Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg appealed the issuance of that low form of discipline. And that resulted in the bar filing a complaint and then having to.
So what's the practicing law here then? Is if they evaluated the case, and I understand that under the Lerner case, evaluating the case is part of practicing law. So if they're outside of Nevada doing their evaluation, but it's for a client in Nevada, that's practicing law here? Is that the rule?
So we submit that that's substantially the rule. The client lived in Nevada. They knew the client lived in Nevada. And this is different than a lot of, I mean, one way in which our particular matter is distinguishable from many of the cases cited by Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg is that it's a discipline case instead of a legal malpractice case. But there's another way in which the cases are substantially distinguishable in that many of those cases involve matters that were pending outside of the state. There's a very finite amount of practicing law involved in this case. And those other cases, for example, you know, one case involved Nevadans hiring someone in Texas to help them with Texas land development. They knew they were going to Texas to get a lawyer for a Texas matter. But in this case, the New York attorneys knew they were coming to Nevada to research and evaluate a Nevada resident's claims.
Ms. Fatini, I apologize for interrupting you. This is Justice Herndon. Let me ask a question, because I think we all share the concern that if there are attorneys that are acting inappropriately, that there should be some discipline. But let's flip this around. Let's say that Nevada attorneys are engaged as whites in Luxembourg or with a New York resident, and that resident complains to the Nevada bar about the Nevada licensed attorneys. Would the Nevada bar have pursued a discipline in the way they did here?
There are a lot of elements to it, but I think pursuant to Supreme Court Rule 91 or 99, the state bar could have sought discipline under the court's jurisdiction for that particular conduct, because the attorney would have been located in Nevada, and I believe that a portion of 99 talks about residing and practicing law there. In addition, Rule of Professional Conduct 8.5 provides that if an attorney engages in misconduct in a different jurisdiction, they can be subject to discipline in Nevada.
And my point being that when you referred earlier to there is no other jurisdiction that could address this issue, I don't know that I agree with that, quite frankly. Mr. Carruth could have complained to the New York Bar Association about the conduct of the New York licensed attorneys in New York in terms of how they failed to communicate with him. So we kind of tend to be reaching ourselves into a jurisdiction that would have similar ability to discipline their licensed bar members.
And so I think that if we look at some of the reasonable, or I submit that if you look at some of the reasonableness factors that go into the civil specific jurisdiction analysis, Nevada is the jurisdiction that is most interested in adjudicating this particular dispute. It is our public that we are protecting. And in the hypothetical question where a Nevada attorney is practicing in New York, we certainly would look at that and evaluate whether or not New York was a more appropriate jurisdiction, and that would be part of the weighing process. My answer was geared more towards the idea that I think that Supreme Court Rule 99 and Rule of Professional Conduct 8.5 allows for jurisdiction, whether or not we felt that we would be the appropriate place to bring the case would turn on more facts.
Justice Silver, Counsel, did you have a question?
Yeah, sorry, I don't know if this has been the worst day ever. I've never done it by video, and every time I go to ask a question, somebody else is. My question is, under Supreme Court Rule 99, and looking at that, what discovery had the state bar done as far as, you know, we know they admitted to nationally advertising, but how many times? We know at least it was seen by this gentleman once, but how many times? And does it make a difference one time versus 100 times? What is regular advertising?
The bar did not explore the extent of the advertising because the bar's focus of the case was the representation of this particular Nevada resident. That the establishing a relationship with this client, a legal representation, and evaluating his claim that was all based on Nevada facts was the basis for pursuing the matter. So we were focused on the firm's communications with the client, not so much the national advertising.
So I'd like to clarify that point. Is the bar seeking to reprimand petitioners because of their advertising or their alleged failure to have submitted their advertising under the advertising rules, or is the bar seeking to reprimand these attorneys based upon their retention by a Nevada resident and that relationship? Which is it, or is it both?
It is the latter. the bar's complaint and the letter of reprimand that was initially issued by the screening panel focused on the representation of this particular Nevada resident.
Okay.
And so to circle back to Rule 99, you are proceeding under the clause practicing law here as the jurisdictional predicate, not whose advertising regularly appears. Is that right?
True. Yes.
And with
and what? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Mr. Williams said that the reprimand acknowledges that that Weitz and Luxembourg was not engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. Is that correct or incorrect?
I think that we did not pursue a claim for unauthorized practice of law. The focus was more on the actual communication with the client and making sure that the conduct of the out-of-state attorneys complied with in-state attorney requirements. And I believe that the particular conduct would fall under an exception of Rule of Professional Conduct 5.5. And so that wasn't the focus of the bar's pursuit of discipline in this case, trying to correct the behavior to protect the public. It wasn't unauthorized practice of law. It was making sure that the practice did comply with the rules that told in-state attorneys to.
Ms. Lucchini, did the retainer agreement identify where any potential litigation would be commenced in pursuit of the claims that Mr. Carruth had?
I believe that Mr. Williams' representation that it identified that the suit may be filed in a different jurisdiction is accurate. I believe that it did reference a perhaps being a multi-jurisdictional complaint or filing under the multi-jurisdictional proposition in a different court or another location pursuant to jurisdictional requirements for the defendant.
But did it indicate that suit could be filed or might be filed in Nevada?
I don't think that it specified any state.
Okay. And then with respect to that same issue, and this question goes to both of you, I'll ask Mr. Williams to address it on rebuttal. In this instance, the determination was made by the law firm not to proceed with the representation. Suppose hypothetically that the law firm had made that decision after the statute of limitations had run. Would that have implicated practicing law in Nevada?
The status of the statute of limitations, impacts more the injury factor and therefore the discipline or the sanction associated with the misconduct than the actual practice of law or the conduct that is the underlying cause of the sanction.
I'm trying to get at is this. When an attorney agrees to evaluate a case, they undertake that evaluation knowing that one of the issues could be timeliness with respect to the claim. And that's an issue that is covered by an evaluation, or I think at least, an issue in practicing law.
Yes, that seems to be a fair evaluation or synopsis of what the evaluation of the claim is. It does appear that the firm took that into consideration in their correspondence with the timing of their correspondence to the client. Respectfully, the bar does not see Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxembourg's conduct as so egregious that it should, result in enjoining them from practicing in Nevada ever, similar to other lawyers that we've brought before you for discipline. But this is particular conduct that needs to be remedied, and the sanctions are there to protect the public and to raise the level of practice and the integrity of our practice. And that's why Barr advocated for the letter of reprimand and pursued the complaint.
All right, thank you. Yes, Justice
Sorry,
Kadish?
I know we're over time, but
yeah, go ahead.
Before we go back for rebuttal, I just need to return to something you alluded to and we haven't talked about, and that is personal jurisdiction, because in my view, Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg still have a right to due process and potential discipline by the bar. So I want you to tell me what these two people did that purposefully availed themselves of our jurisdiction such that it's okay to proceed here.
Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg are the named partners of the firm that established this particular practice, way of retaining the client, and they are ultimately responsible for the conduct of their firm in the representation of particular clients. And that's why they were named in the complaint specifically.
So do the firm's contacts get attributed to them for personal jurisdiction analysis?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Williams, you may proceed with rebuttal, and I'll add 3 minutes to your time.
I very much appreciate that, Your Honor. Let me pick up with Justice Kadish's last question. I think, most respectfully to my colleague, the answer to the question of whether the firm's contacts can be attributed to the individual lawyers is no. We cited two cases that dealt with that scenario. One was the Schur case out of California, Ninth Circuit case out of California. The other one was the Media Worldwide case decided by Judge George here in the District of Nevada. And very quickly, the point that was made is that while the individual's lawyers' contacts with a forum may be attributable to the law firm, the reverse is not true. And carrying it a step further, one partner's contacts with a jurisdiction cannot be attributed to a different partner's contacts with the jurisdiction. The law is clear that if you're looking at personal jurisdiction, the minimum contacts question has to be satisfied for each defendant. And so, or in this case, each respondent. Carrying that issue a bit further, Justice Kadish, because this circles back to the initial questions you asked about what did Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg do? And I would submit the answer is nothing. To subject themselves to disciplinary jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction in Nevada. And it wasn't just me that was asking that question, or that you that was just asking that question. The vice chair asked that question. Because even though he denied our motion to dismiss, if you look at the last page or the penultimate page of the order, I can't remember which, there is a footnote in which the vice chair says, I'm denying this motion, but there are problems with this complaint, and I would strongly encourage the bar to consider amending it, because I don't know, I'm paraphrasing now, because I don't know why Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg are individually named. What did they do? I think the bar should spell that out. He gave the bar 15 days to amend, and it never did. So I would submit that's probably because amending would be futile, because Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg have put in the evidence on this issue, and they had no contacts with Nevada.
Mr. Williams, yes. What about the state bar's claim that it was these two gentlemen that had gone over with the receptionist what questions to ask the prospective clients on the phone? To go over the retainer agreement, because that's, maybe I got that wrong factually, but supposedly that form was created by these partners who went over it with the receptionist, the retainer agreement.
I don't know that the evidence shows that it was these two partners that prepared that form, but let me just say it this way. There obviously is an obligation of supervision for partners in law firms, but there's no allegation here that if you look at the complaint, there's no allegation that they failed in their supervisory responsibility in that regard. And so that's being brought up now as the basis why they were individually named, but there's no allegation that they, you know, didn't perform their obligations. And so when we go back to that issue of the retainer agreement and how Mr. Carruth came to sign it, I have to take issue with my colleague's position that that was practicing law in Nevada. It's fact specific for each case. Here, it wasn't a determination whether Mr. Carruth had a viable claim at that stage, and then, okay, let's sign you up and pursue the case. It was, do you meet an initial set of criteria that merits further investigation, which I think distinguishes it from Lerner. Once the records were gathered, the evaluation was conducted, and then that was practicing law. I admit that. But that occurred in New York. And some of the questioning I've heard, and it sounds like my colleague said that Supreme Court Rule 99 can be interpreted to say that essentially representing a Nevada client, no matter where the case is enough to subject you to jurisdiction, disciplinary jurisdiction in Nevada. And I just can't agree with that. I think that, number one, runs afoul of the Supreme Court Rule 99's plain language. It just doesn't say that. It specifies four bases for jurisdiction. None of them say just representing a Nevada client is enough to subject you to jurisdiction. So I think that would create a procedural due process problem for the lack of notice.
Mr. Williams, if I could, this is Justice Herndon. I'm curious, in light of the bar's concession today that they were proceeding against your clients under the portion of Rule 99 for practicing law here in Nevada, if that's coupled with their factual finding that your clients were not engaging in the unauthorized practice of law, was it at all explained to your clients how those two things could coexist if they're not licensed
here? That was never explained, but I think, in fairness, I think what I heard my colleague say in oral argument was that there are certain exceptions under Rule 5.5, which governs the unauthorized practice of law. In other words, if you're engaged in investigation, for example, in the jurisdiction that's ancillary to a claim that may be filed elsewhere, that's not the unauthorized practice of law, but it's the type of practice of law that could subject you to disciplinary jurisdiction under RPC 5.5E. So if I were going to try to evaluate or interpret the basis, I think that would probably be it. But I think where that falls down in terms of being able to impose disciplinary jurisdiction here is, again, the key language is, quote, in this jurisdiction. Mr. Weitz and Mr. Luxemburg never entered the jurisdiction. They did not conduct their investigation in this jurisdiction. So I want to quickly, if I can, respond to Justice Hardesty's hypothetical with respect to the evaluation of the claim and whether a decision on that claim being made before or after the running of the statute of limitations is significant here. I think Bar Counsel got it right when she said that goes more to the injury component of Mr. Carruth than it does to practicing law or not. But I wanted to make very clear for the record what claim we're talking about here, because the retainer agreement in its opening paragraph stated that the firm was not going to be pursuing a medical malpractice claim on behalf of Mr. Carruth. That's what he's complaining about, that the statute of limitations ultimately ran on that claim. Well, the firm told him at the beginning, when they signed the retainer agreement in August of 17, that's not the claim we're pursuing. We will investigate a product defect claim. And the evaluation took place of that claim, and the determination was made not to proceed forward prior to the statute of limitations running on that claim. The bar has alleged that Mr. Carruth did not read the retainer agreement. We obviously have no personal knowledge of that. That would be an issue for Mr. Carruth to address. But if that's the case, I think under the law there are consequences for not reading agreements that you sign. Let's see if there was anything else that I wanted to get to. I guess as a final point, the bar has cleared up that it's not pursuing jurisdiction based on advertising, and I think that may help solve some of the distinction between personal jurisdiction cases and disciplinary jurisdiction cases, because I think if the focus is on practicing law in one form or another in Nevada, that's not really going to raise any due process concerns, contrasted with a situation where if you are seeking to impose liability purely for advertising, that I think would need to be pressure tested against some constitutional principles, but it sounds like we don't have that issue here anymore. I would respectfully submit the matter and thank both the court and my colleague for its consideration of of my prior issue, and my clients certainly thank the court for its serious consideration of this important matter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Williams. Ms. Fulchini, we appreciate your arguments and your briefs. The second time is always better than the first. Thank you all very much. It'll